Welcome to Talk Nation Radio, a half-hour discussion on politics, human rights, and the environment. I'm Dori Smith, and our guest is nuclear industry whistleblower Paul Blanch, as we take another look at safety measures at American nuclear plants, many like the ones built in Fukushima, Japan, that suffered hydrogen gas explosions after the earthquake and tsunami there in early March. We asked Paul Blanch to talk about his history in the nuclear industry and some of his recent concerns.
I started in the nuclear Navy 45 years ago, trained as a nuclear reactor operator instructor. I have a degree in electrical engineering, registered professional engineer, worked for Northeast Utilities for approximately 27 years in the nuclear field. I guess I was a whistleblower. I worked for Maine Yankee. I've worked for Entergy. I've worked for Consolidated Edison. I've done contract work for Nuclear Energy Institute, Electric Power Research Institute. I am an expert witness for the license renewal for Indian Point, working for the New York Attorney General, expert witness on Seabrook Nuclear Power Plant license renewal, been involved in Vermont Yankee and the license renewal and power uprate, and involved in Pilgrim license renewal.
Well, Paul Blanch, thank you very much for joining us to talk about Connecticut and Japan and the way these two countries and peoples are intersecting now. I know that a lot of folks feel that here in Connecticut, we are so far from Japan that we need to only be concerned for the Japanese and not ourselves. And I'd like to sort of start there because I'd like to get your perspective on that. I know you've been at this a long time, so just share what you feel like we should know.
I'm quite surprised at the extent of the accident. It's certainly beyond what I ever imagined and certainly beyond what anyone ever imagined. And I was also an expert witness on the Three Mile Island litigation on the technical side. What I've seen occur here is, as I say, way beyond anyone's wildest imagination. And I am very familiar with the Millstone plants and been working with respect to the Indian Point plants on the license renewal, working for the New York Attorney General. And I'm working with other media and Congress people, and they've asked me what is the most dangerous plant, in my opinion. And clearly, my response to that is Indian Point for a number of reasons. Indian Point, number one, is located in an extremely high population zone, higher than any other nuclear power plant probably in the world. In addition, and I have filed a formal petition with the NRC, which they rapidly rejected, all the natural gas that comes to New England from Texas not only passes near the Indian Point site, it goes right through the Indian Point site. One 30-inch diameter gas lines and two 26 diameter gas lines. And if they ruptured in a resulting fire like we had out in San Bruno last September, San Bruno, California, these lines can become essentially a 1,000-foot high or long blowtorch, depending on the direction of the wind. That event, whether it be a terrorist or just a corrosion problem with the pipe or whatever, someone making an error, could do significant damage to the Indian Point plants. When I say significant damage, I know it could wipe out all the offsite power, all the onsite power, because there's about a 2 million gallon storage tank for the onsite power. It could starve the diesel generators of oxygen. It could incapacitate the people on the site. And the Indian Point site actually has more radioactive material on site than Fukushima had on site. We see the results of the cesium and the iodine-131 dispersion, and we see by some reports that can go out to as much as 500 miles, depending on which way the wind is blowing. Obviously, if it's blowing from the west to the east, we here in Connecticut are in extreme danger. These plumes can spread a lot of radioactivity very quickly, and we don't have time for any reasonable evacuation. If the winds are blowing out of the north down toward New York City, we know that New York City would be heavily impacted by the radiation released. And I'm talking primarily from the spent fuel pools. That's where most of the radioactive material is. Everyone seems to be concerned about releases from the reactor, and that certainly is a concern. But I have to agree with the industry that the reactor is fairly well protected with about 4 feet of concrete, but with loss of off-site power within a half a day or maybe a day, we could have a release from the reactor if we have no AC power from either off-site or on-site. So there is a potential from Indian Point, and Entergy is the operator of that plant, and I've actually witnessed their operations. Their maintenance is poor. Their programs are poor for doing maintenance and detecting corrosion. They have underground cables that have been inadvertently submerged in brackish water, meaning it contains high concentrations of salt. And there are just so many problems with Indian Point that I'm not the only one with this opinion. The governor of Indian Point and the attorney general and many of the politicians in New York believe that that plant is not worth the risk that it presents given the potential consequences of an accident.
Now, that brings us to the question about the operation of these plants, even despite known dangers. And the Japanese, of course, knew that they were on earthquake fault lines. They'd had plenty of earthquakes. Also, you know, seismologists were warning about the fragile nature of the tectonic plates beneath them at just the time that those earthquakes occurred. So it's not that we don't get these warnings about the safety at nuclear plants, but what would you say overrides our best instincts to protect humanity in cases like this in favor of obtaining this kind of power?
Yeah, it's, again, having worked for utilities, nuclear utilities, for more than 30 years, I'm well aware that every decision that is made with the operation of these plants, and I have been in positions where I've reported to the chief nuclear officer at Millstone and Connecticut Yankee and Maine Yankee and so on and so forth, and in Indian Point. And I know that every decision that they make is based on economics. And we don't have an effective regulator. We have a regulator who has is very sympathetic to the nuclear industry, and quite a few people have said, and I'll quote Victor Galinsky, who was a commissioner at the time of Three Mile Island, that the Nuclear Regulatory Commission is a fully owned subsidiary of the nuclear industry. Whatever the nuclear industry wants to get away with, the NRC will let them do that. And I've used the phrase before that the Nuclear Regulatory Commission is not unlike a parasite too afraid to take too big a bite out of its host for fear of killing its host and dying. And if it imposes too many requirements on the industry will not survive, and the NRC will not survive. And it is the most renegade regulator, and this is not just my opinion, it's the opinion of many people, including ex-commissioners, various high-level media people, congressional people, that it's probably the most irresponsible regulator that we have. And the gas line is just one case. We have seen so many instances of irresponsible regulatory action by the NRC. One of them came 2 days after the Fukushima accident, where they issued a 20-year extension to Vermont Yankee, thumbing their nose at the general public and saying, we're going to do what we want to do. And as far as regulations, and I have many contacts within the Nuclear Regulatory Commission, they don't even know what regulations are applicable to various plants, and it's impossible. And I've asked the NRC in writing to identify what regulations are applicable to particular plants like Indian Point, Vermont Yankee. And basically, they say in a very political way, we don't know what regulations are applicable. It's a pretty sad situation. It's a situation where we have a lot of radioactive material on every site, and it presents an extreme danger. And I'm not an anti-nuclear person. I'm a pro-safety person. And I've got many examples of where economics overrides safety. And I testified a few weeks ago before the Massachusetts legislature. And we took a look at the Pilgrim Nuclear Power Plant, which is very similar to the Fukushima nuclear power plants. And that plant, the spent fuel pools were designed to hold 800 spent fuel elements because there is no reprocessing, and Yucca Mountain is essentially out of the question. The NRC allows them to overload these spent fuel pools, and at Pilgrim, and this is just an example that holds true for every nuclear power plant, originally designed to hold 800 elements, is now holding 3,801 elements, meaning that those number of elements are more than Fukushima, and the amount of radioactive material there in Indian Point, Vermont Yankee, and just about every other power plant around does contain more radioactivity than Fukushima. And the possibility of an event causing damage to the spent fuel pools is it's remote, but it can happen, and the only thing we can say for sure is we know what the consequences can be, and we've observed the consequences at Fukushima, and they're beyond our wildest dreams or our wildest nightmares, as evidenced by the releases at Fukushima. The fortunate thing at Fukushima, it was located on the east coast of Japan, and probably 90% to 95% or 99% of the radioactive material was dispersed out over the Pacific Ocean, so it got diluted significantly. And as far as harm to the general population, fortunately, it could have been a lot worse. It could have been 100 times worse had it been located inland or on the other side of the Japanese coast.
Well, I've wondered about that because, for one thing, earthquakes have still been going on in Japan.
Correct.
For another, they've said we're 9 months away from shutdown, and I'm not quite sure what they mean by shutdown, but they're trying to contain the heat there still, and they're still having trouble keeping it down. So let's go into that. I mean, you were talking about essentially the level of radiation located at a site, and here they still have radioactivity. They still have enough potential for what's called a recriticality, right? That I guess we have to be worried about this as an ongoing disaster. And can you talk about that? And also, when you talk about the dilution of the radioactivity, you're talking about the half-life of this stuff and also the extent to which it will be carried to other locations. Explain what you mean there, because I know there's going to be toxicity in the waters, the fish are going to be picking it up, and some of it, of course, has blown as far as the West Coast and beyond, even to Connecticut. So when we're talking about that, what do we mean, and what are the real dangers?
There is so much misinformation coming out, and it's very hard for me as a nuclear engineer expert to filter the information to determine what is accurate information and what is inaccurate information. We have seen reports, we have seen experts that said, one expert said there was a nuclear explosion in Unit 3, and his conclusion was based on very, very questionable data. And with me, I am reluctant, because of my credibility, which is very important to me, I will not make assumptions based on unverified information and what I think may have happened based on that information. But with respect to Fukushima, I think we know that the reactor vessels most likely have been breached, meaning that the radioactive material from the cores located in units 1, 2, and 3, while they're still cooling it, that water is leaking out into the ocean and some of it into the air. With respect to Unit 4, they had a very, very severe hydrogen explosion and or uncovery, and that released a lot of radiation. The recriticality, in my mind, unconfirmed. I've seen all kinds of data from International Atomic Energy Agency, from TEPCO, from the regulator over there, and I just can't really come to any firm conclusion whether they have had recriticality. If the information is accurate, some of the information that says the iodine levels are going up, I'd say, yeah, that's a possibility. If it's confirmed that there is neutron radiation around there, that would mean we have a recriticality. But I have no confirmation that is occurring. I think what can be said right now is that the amount of radiation being released from Fukushima continues to decrease daily, both from decay and because they are limiting the amount of radiation from the air, and they're trying to keep the fuel covered. I'm not sure they're being successful, but I think the Unit 4 spent fuel pool is now covered with water. So I think they are on the road to recovery, but obviously they're still releasing significant amount of radiation, primarily to the water. I'm not sure about how much is being released to the air. Again, we're not getting good, complete, and thorough information.
Now, you mentioned before what we're dealing with here is partly cesium. And I know it's cesium, it's radioactive iodine-131. And can you just go through those particles and what the fact that they did leak means, let's say, for the Japanese people who have to eat their food grown in the region, and then for people all over the world, what that release means? Because, you know, we're so often told that at least the iodine is degrading and it has a half-life of 7 days or so. So we can look at it being half after 7 days and then half again and so on.
Correct.
But even so, I mean, it's dispersed and dangerous still, isn't it?
Oh, it's extremely dangerous. And when you have a nuclear meltdown like they've had, the primary element initially of concern is iodine-131 with its 8-day half-life. And the reason that is a concern, it is very volatile. It is essentially a gas, and it is released. And it tends to settle down on the ground, the vegetation, and tends to concentrate. If people drink the water that is contaminated with iodine-131, then iodine tends to go to the thyroid, and there'll be very high levels of iodine-131. That's why we are advised to take potassium iodide if there is a major release of a core melt in an active core. That does not apply to a normal spent fuel pool, because the fuel's been in there for years, and so the amount of iodine is essentially decayed away. But in an active core at Fukushima 1, 2, and 3, the iodine was released and will cause an increase in thyroid cancers. Now, the other element or isotope that we have to be concerned about is another volatile element. It's cesium-137, and also cesium-134. Cesium-137 has a half-life of about 30 years, I believe. And that becomes airborne and is distributed, well, primarily, well, it'll go out a few hundred miles, but it's very dangerous because it does tend to stay in the body, and it doesn't decay away very rapidly. So the body, especially children, will be exposed to significant radiations from the cesium-137, which is really our primary concern right now, I believe. Again, it's statistically going to cause an increase in cancers to those people who are exposed directly to the cesium, or if the cesium is deposited on the soil or in the houses and so on and so forth, and they're residing there, the dose that they're going to get over a year and over their lifetime is statistically going to cause a increase in cancer rate, sort of like what happened at Chernobyl. Cesium became airborne and contaminated thousands and thousands of square miles all the way up to northern Norway and Finland, and you know, people couldn't eat the reindeer, and the milk was somewhat contaminated. But it's the exposure from these long-lived isotopes like cesium-137 that are statistically going to cause increased cancers and danger to fetuses, if that's the proper term, birth defects and so forth. So it's really in the long term the cesium that is going to do damage to the population. A lot of people seem to be concerned about plutonium, but plutonium, again, being a very, very heavy element, is going to tend, if it does come out of the fuel, tend to be a local hazard, and we haven't really seen any significant signs of plutonium except in fuel, well, some fuel rods that were blown out of Fukushima, but as far as airborne plutonium traveling across the Pacific, we have not seen any of that. I think what we have seen here in the United States is iodine-131, some cesium-134, and cesium-137. Those are the primary isotopes that we have seen here in the United States.
Now, we did get a letter from someone asking us to find out if there had been any detection in Japan or elsewhere of strontium-90.
I have truthfully not seen any reports addressing strontium-90. Now, that doesn't mean that it hasn't been released, because strontium-90 is in the fuel. It's a long-lived isotope. I know we had it at Chernobyl. I just have not seen any reports on strontium-90 with respect to Fukushima, which in some cases I wonder why we haven't seen it. We have had explosions. We don't have complete information, and I don't know why we have not seen any reports. I haven't seen any reports of strontium-89 or strontium-90 being detected anywhere in the world. Maybe I haven't seen all the information, but I just, you know, what I've read, I haven't seen anything.
And Paul Blanche, about some of what's going on in Connecticut, we did together sit in an audience with Dr. Edward Wilds. He's director of radiation monitoring for the state DEP in Connecticut. And citizens were concerned, and they invited him to come and talk about health risks associated with Fukushima. He talked about some of the steps involved in the disaster and the repercussions, and some of what the questions, you know, were from the audience had to do with radioactive particles, as we're discussing here now. As it turned out, he really wasn't even getting the kind of data that he would have liked to have. So let's start there, because how do DEP agencies like his on a state level obtain that kind of data? Where does it come from, and what can they do if they don't feel like they have enough of it?
I think with respect to an accident that occurs remote from the United States, I think the Department of Energy and also nuclear power plants, and I've heard from some of the NRC inspectors at nuclear power plants, and they have radiation monitoring, which will detect iodine and will detect cesium. So, they may get some data, like Ed Wild being local to Connecticut, he would get data, I believe, only from Millstone. So if Millstone picked up iodine-131, which they have, he would get those reports. Now, the amount of iodine that was picked up at Millstone was insignificant and not harmful. I mean, it certainly was from Fukushima, but it wasn't harmful radiation. And, I don't believe that anyone in Connecticut, as a result of Fukushima, was exposed to anything significant from that event. But if there is an accident, for instance, at Millstone, and I was at that meeting where Dr. Ed Wiles, who I've known for more than 20 years, talked about the distribution of potassium iodide, and then let's assume for some reason they did have an accident that released a significant amount of iodine and the winds were blowing toward a populated zone like Hartford, and there were 20-mile-an-hour winds, and in 2 hours we're going to have significant amount of iodine. About all you can do there is probably the best action is bend over and kiss your butt goodbye, but there is no way with a few hours warning, be it Hartford, Connecticut, or New York City, if the iodine plume was heading toward one of those populated areas, and I think a question was brought up, where do we go to get potassium iodide? I think if one went into my local drugstore and said, hey, I want some potassium iodide to block the iodine-131 from my thyroid, they'd say, what? I don't think that, well, certainly there's not sufficient potassium iodide available in the state of Connecticut, and certainly not in New York City. Plus that, people don't know where to go to get it. And if you did know where to get it, I don't think there'd be adequate supplies. And what I believe is that not only the states, but I think it has to be on the national level, that wherever there is a potential that people could be exposed to significant amounts of iodine-131, whether that's 10 miles or 50 miles from a nuclear power plant or 500 miles, the Nuclear Regulatory Commission should make that available to people on short notice, and they ought to publicize it. They are very, very reluctant to distribute potassium iodide, because that would be an admission by the nuclear industry, by the Nuclear Regulatory Commission, that it is a possibility that a major nuclear accident would occur. And they don't want to admit that a major nuclear accident would occur and affect anyone outside of a 10-mile radius. That's why we don't see any requirement for evacuation outside of a 10-mile radius.
Paul Blanch spent some 27 years in the nuclear field working for major corporations and is now an expert witness on license renewal for New England nuclear power plants. For Talk Nation Radio, I'm Dori Smith. This program is produced in Storrs, Connecticut and syndicated with Pacifica Network. TalkNationRadio.org for transcripts, audio, and discussions.